From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama says the government will no longer give certain military-style equipment to local police departments.
We'll have more on that, but first to Iraq, where ISIS is claiming a big victory in the city of Ramadi, just 70 miles away from Baghdad. Joining us from Erbil is Mitch Prothero, Iraq Bureau Chief for McClatchy. And Mitch, what are you hearing today about Ramadi and the latest there?
Well, what we found today is essentially it's almost like the hangover day, as everybody accepts that the weekend went terribly for the Iraqi government. It appears as though the Islamic State is consolidating its control over the population, and the government is pushing out basically Iranian-backed Shia militias, who might be some of their only remaining military forces. They're pushing them out to an airbase about 12 to 15 miles on the outskirts of Ramadi to prepare for a counterattack. The other issue that we're hearing, though, is that the Islamic State itself understands that's going to happen and is pushing their forces out towards that very same airbase, where I'd expect in the next day or so there's going to be a massive confrontation.
And how did this happen? How did we get to this point where Ramadi appears to be under ISIS control?
Well, you know, if you look at the geography, much of Anbar province had fallen to the Islamic State and to what we'd say disenfranchised Sunni Muslim tribes who were very unhappy with the Maliki government. This happened actually 6 months before the fall of Mosul last year. Ramadi had been holding out, at least in the city center. It's the provincial capital, so it had a lot of government infrastructure and sort of some pro-government tribes involved. But if you look at the map again, it's fairly isolated. It had been basically completely surrounded by unfriendly territory for almost a year and a half. Then basically what we saw was a tactical move by the Islamic State. They clearly planned this offensive for some time and used a combination of what the U.S. military would say, like combined arms, where they used bulldozers, suicide bombers, heavy artillery, heavy machine guns, and then very quick-moving troops to basically encircle, terrorize, and demoralize the Iraqi garrison, which ended up fleeing over the course of the weekend.
And giving up a lot of equipment that the U.S. had provided to them. And this is something that we saw in previous battles where the Islamic State was able to take U.S. equipment that the Iraqi forces just abandoned in the middle of battle. But Mitch, when we talked to you about the Battle of Tikrit, it appeared that things were moving in the other direction, that was a battle that Iraq was able to win with U.S. air support, that ISIS was pushed back out of Tikrit.
Right. And the situations, geographically, they're different. Tikrit sort of stuck out as one of the furthest south outposts of the Islamic State, relatively close to Baghdad, and in an area where the Iraqi forces could move fairly easily to and from, you know, the battle space. There's some question as to how much the Islamic State wished to defend such an exposed city as Tikrit. And it's entirely possible now that we're seeing that maybe they pulled out a lot of their forces, as were rumored at the time. Even so, that took a month, multiple airstrikes, and incredibly heavy casualties on the side of the Iraqi forces. So when you came around to Ramadi, you know, it's much more isolated if you're the Iraqi government. It's much larger. And, you know, the Islamic State was able to really tactically sort of outmaneuver them and take everybody sort of by surprise.
And was the U.S. involved in trying to defend Ramadi at all?
Yeah, we have a report today that over the 72 hours, they dropped, I believe, 19 specific airstrikes in defense of the garrison, which, again, is, you know, it can be a lot if you're in the wide open desert. But when you're talking about trying to identify targets in house-to-house urban fighting, this is a very dense urban environment, it's going to be incredibly difficult, particularly when you realize that, you know, there aren't trained American forward air controller sitting there guiding those strikes down. You're essentially going off of drone footage or off of Iraqi guys calling in, you know, positions of the enemy that then have to be approved. You have to fly a drone over it to make sure civilians aren't there. So it's just a much more complicated process and doesn't allow you to drop bombs nearly as precisely in such a built-up urban area.
How much threat is there that ISIS takes Baghdad at some point?
I don't think there's much threat that they'll take Baghdad, although I do knock on wood. The fact is Baghdad's really controlled by these Shia militias, and the Islamic State hasn't shown an ability to take over and control areas that don't at least have some sympathetic population to them, like we've seen in Ramadi, Mosul, places like this are all predominantly conservative tribal Sunni areas. But they have done a number of surprising operations in the past. I wouldn't be shocked if we saw more military activity by them with, you know, inside Baghdad itself, whether it's via terrorist attacks or specific attacks on ministries or, you know, military positions. But taking it over seems a little far-fetched right now. But again, nobody thought they could take over Mosul and nobody thought they could take over Ramadi.
That's Mitch Prothero, the Iraq bureau chief for McClatchy, speaking with us from Erbil in Iraq. Mitch, thank you so much as always.
Oh, it's always my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, today in Camden, New Jersey, President Obama is announcing a ban on the federal government supplying local police departments with military-style equipment like tracked armored vehicles and grenade launchers, and there will be restrictions on other military-style equipment as well. Let's get police reaction. Frank Baker is the undersheriff in Allegan County, Michigan. In 2013, his department picked up a Humvee and mine-resistant armored vehicle, or MRAP. When those kinds of vehicles were used by police at the demonstrations in Ferguson, the president asked for a review. The report is out today, and with it, the president's ban. So, Under Sheriff Baker, your thoughts on this ban on things like tracked tanks?
Well, I think that, you know, in light of some of the things that have occurred around the nation, I can understand why there's a concern, even though, you know, here in Allegan County, we may not agree with maybe everything that's occurring, because we certainly feel there is a positive community purpose in having types of vehicles like this. Ours, the ones that we have, don't actually have tracks, but they're definitely a mine-resistant vehicle, which means that it's something that we can use to provide officer safety in situations.
Well, tell us more about that, because certainly you're not thinking of, well, maybe you are thinking of landmines.
No, not at all. What we're looking at is the ability to place our officers in a position where they can maybe negotiate and talk to people who are armed. And recently we've had a couple of three incidents in which we were able just to do that. And that is, you know, drive right up next to a person who had barricaded himself in a vehicle, and we believed him to be armed at the time. And we're able to drive right next to him and, you know, be able to talk to him, communicate with him, and do that without fear of injury to the officers involved. And I think that it's one of the reasons that we've had successful, what we call successful conclusions of these situations in which nobody was hurt, no officers were hurt, and the person involved had obviously decided not to hurt himself or hurt anyone else, and we were able to resolve it.
Well, as you know, the federal interagency group that released the report today found substantial risk of misusing or overusing the items that are now banned, and they include weaponized aircraft, firearms, ammunition of 50 caliber or higher, grenade launchers, bayonets, camouflage uniforms. I mean, do you think some of those should be banned? Do you worry that, for instance, if a police department has camouflage uniforms, people, the lines will be blurred. People will not know that's their local police. They will think it is the military.
Well, I certainly can understand some of the concern. I think that, you know, most agencies understand that and do take precautions. I know with ours, you know, we have received uniforms over the years through the military, and with those we have patches sewn on them, and they have vests on that identify themselves as sheriff's deputies. And anytime that, you know, we're out engaged in any type of activity that could result in any type of use of force, we want to make sure that people recognize us as law enforcement. I think that's our obligation. And one of the things that I think obviously helps is having a, you know, a relationship with your community and doing things that allow the community to be a part of your organization, so that there's a level of trust there that that may not be in all areas in our nation. And with us, you know, we try to involve the community in some of our decision making, and also in making them aware of what we do have, so that they know that its purpose is intended for, you know, the peaceful outcome of situations, as opposed to maybe somebody that may think that their police is looking at it from more of an offensive standpoint.
Well, so the MRAP that you support, that would not be banned, but you'd have to have a tighter scrutiny of having something like that. The suggestion is that starting in October, police will have to get approval from the city council, the mayor, or some other local governing body for things like armored vehicles, manned aircraft, drones, explosives, battering rams. How do you feel about that, leaving the decision as to whether or not to have these items up to your mayor or city council?
Well, we've actually kind of crossed that bridge here in Allegan County already. We had acquired some of this type of equipment, and our county board of commissioners, you know, became aware of it and got involved in that decision making. And as a result of, you know, they're wanting to be a part of that, and I think rightfully so, they should be a part of that. They then began looking at our input. And then we have a process where our input is considered, and then a decision is made from the county board of commissioners level as to whether or not to accept that type of equipment. And that kind of provides a level of oversight, I think, but also then includes the opinion of the law enforcement experts as to whether or not the equipment is needed, and then we can provide, you know, what purpose we feel we need it for, and then they can kind of look at it from maybe beyond our perspective as to whether or not it is appropriate for us to have that kind of equipment.
That's Allegan County, Michigan Undersheriff Frank Baker on the president's announcement today prohibiting the federal government from giving some military-style equipment to local police departments. Undersheriff Baker, thank you.
Thank you.
9 people are dead, nearly 200 are in police custody, and a restaurant is closed after a biker gang meetup in Waco, Texas, turned into a shootout and a brawl. Joining us from Waco is Naomi Martin, public safety reporter for the Dallas Morning News. And Naomi, what are things like in Waco today?
Well, there's a lot of uniformed officers all around. You have FBI agents in camo. It's a tense scene still. There's still a lot of crime scene evidence going on. The investigators are still picking up bullet casings and processing blood. So it's still a very active crime scene, even though we're coming up on 24 hours since it happened.
And what more do we know about what actually happened yesterday?
Well, basically, they've arrested 192 suspected bike gang members involved in this incident, and police are saying that they believe 200 biker gang members were meeting to address recruitment and turf issues and basically show off their colors to each other and brag to each other. And the police believe that some sort of fight started in the bathroom and then spilled out into the restaurant, and then, you know, shots were fired inside the restaurant, shots were fired outside the restaurant. There were knives, clubs, chains, brass knuckles used. The police were waiting outside because they said the restaurant wouldn't let them come in and wouldn't cooperate with them in advance, even though they knew this was coming. And so police eventually fired shots at the suspects, and the suspects returned fire, or, you know, vice versa. It's still a little unclear the order of events. But in any case, 9 were dead and 18 were wounded. Most of those were gunshot wounds. Some were stab wounds.
Well, when you say that the police say the restaurant knew this was coming, explain more about that. What was actually known about the potential for violence?
Yeah, so basically the Waco police had intelligence that these bike gangs, which are very well known in this area for their propensity for violence, they knew that this meetup was happening. They knew it was going to be a large crowd, large violent crowd with weapons. And the police, they said they've been approaching them for 2 months now. You know, they ideally wanted them to deny service to these biker gangs because they're very noticeable. They're wearing these patches. They're wearing their colors on their vests and headbands. And the police wanted them to deny service ideally, or at least let the police be inside the establishment to secure the area because it is private property. But they said the restaurant was very uncooperative. They said they didn't want anything to do with them, basically. So the police felt like they weren't allowed to be inside. They didn't even have plainclothes officers inside, but they did have about 10 SWAT officers in uniform with marked cars right outside the entrance.
And this kind of story is obviously shocking all over the country. But how does it feel there in Texas, where you have a little more familiarity with these biker gangs?
Well, it's funny. You know, the law enforcement is not surprised at all. I think average civilians, however, are pretty shaken up. There have been a lot of questions from readers about, you know, are we safe and what areas should we be avoiding? And I think, you know, the general public is probably pretty shaken up.
That's Naomi Martin, the public safety reporter for the Dallas Morning News, joining us from Waco. Naomi, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And now to more fallout from the war in Afghanistan. In 2009, Congress created the Special Immigrant Visa Program, allowing interpreters, Afghans, who spent more than a year working for U.S. forces to apply for a visa. The process had been long, complicated, and secretive, but after a series of reforms in 2013, it improved, and now more than 15,000 Afghans and their families have relocated to the U.S. and have green cards. But as difficult as it is for Afghans to get visas to come here, that might be the easy part. Sean Carberry, who knew many interpreters during his long stint reporting in Afghanistan, found many struggling to build lives here.
26-year-old Amanullah Syed spent 7 years interpreting for U.S. forces in Afghanistan. He worked in some of the most dangerous parts of the country. It took him years to navigate the convoluted visa process. He and his family arrived in the U.S. in late February. I met Syed walking the streets of his new hometown of Woodbridge, Virginia. He was looking for work, spending up to 8 hours a day looking for help wanted signs.
Are you getting any help from any government agencies or charities at this point to help you find a job or direct you on even how best to apply for a job or present yourself here?
Yes, they did type of training, the Catholic Charity, the Migrants Office.
Catholic Charities is one of 9 agencies contracted by the federal government to provide assistance to refugees.
We are their clients. Short two days training that how to make resumes, how to find a job here in the U.S., how to apply online. They did. We're doing our best, but personally, I don't have a computer and internet to apply for jobs. I applied many times from the library. I went to the library, used that internet, and apply online.
Catholic Charities also provided beds, dishes, and a dining room set for Syed's small one-bedroom apartment. But the couches came from a different source.
Well, I got these from trash. I just washed it with antibiotics and then some soap for the health reasons. Cleaned it up and I'm using it.
Syed is approaching the end of his period of rental assistance and will soon have to pay for his apartment on his own.
I'm really depressed because of that. What will happen? My kids will be on the street, so I don't want them to happen like that, to be on the street. If I find a job now, it's okay. If I don't, then that's the question. Who will support and who will help?
A few weeks after I interviewed him, Syed did find a job, but everything's not okay. He's working more than 50 hours a week, but he's not earning enough to afford the rent. He's now looking for a second job and a cheaper apartment. While his rent support is ending, he still has food stamps and Medicaid. About 70% of Afghan interpreters come to the U.S. with the assistance of a refugee agency. They receive the same package of benefits as refugees fleeing violence in Syria or South Sudan.
Hello.
Hi.
But yeah, we're here to pick up some furniture for our Afghan friends, so.
Hey, that's wonderful news.
Yeah. Let's go shopping.
That's not acceptable to U.S. Army Reserve Captain Matt Zeller. He's the founder of No One Left Behind. It's a nonprofit that provides assistance to interpreters in the D.C. area.
These guys are veterans. They did tours of combat just like we did.
This is a personal cause for Zeller. While on a mission in Afghanistan, his interpreter picked up a gun and killed 2 Taliban who were ambushing their position.
He literally saved my life. To me, he's an American veteran, and we ought to be taking care of folks like we do our other fellow veterans.
Zeller helped get his former interpreter, Janice Shinwari, to the U.S. a year and a half ago.
Janice, what do we need?
Yeah, we need some couches and a dining table.
Okay.
And some dishes.
All right, so I'll be on dishes. You guys are on couches.
Now Shinwari and other Afghans spend their weekends visiting thrift shops like Pender Methodist in Chantilly, Virginia. The shop donates furniture and kitchen supplies that Zeller and his team deliver to newly arrived interpreters. Zeller says the first person No One Left Behind helped was an interpreter named Ajmal Fakhri. He once served as translator to former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates.
When we found Ajmal, he was living homeless on the streets of San Francisco with his wife, his 4-year-old son, and his 2-year-old daughter. We flew them out to Maryland so that he could be closer to people that he knew, helped him find an apartment, furnished that home, helped him get a job, bought him a car, and it sort of snowballed from there.
Larry Bartlett is director of refugee assistance programs at the State Department. He acknowledges that it's a tough transition for Afghans.
It's a program that allows people to arrive, but then expects them to become self-sufficient economically.
And do so quickly. With the surge in processing of visas for Afghans and the greater number of refugees fleeing violence in the world, resources are stretched.
There's a bit of a tension because the federal funding for this program is limited. and the needs of the population, as the needs of refugees who are recently resettled here, are perhaps greater than the federal funding can allow.
Bartlett says there's no talk of extending additional benefits to Afghan interpreters, though as hard as it is initially, many Afghans are succeeding in the U.S. Such as Shinwari, Zeller's former interpreter. He struggled initially, but now he has a full-time job, and on the weekends he likes to drive the delivery van for No One Left Behind. He says he's happy in the U.S. now.
I like it. Nice place. And the important thing, we are secure. We don't have to be live in the fear like we did in Afghanistan.
Today, they're delivering furniture to a newly arrived family in Riverdale, Maryland. This apartment complex is where Ajmal Fakhri lives, along with a number of other Afghan families. Looking around the rundown complex, the first question I ask Fakhri is if he feels safe living here.
No. We left Afghanistan because we thought we were going to be safe. And if a person comes to your apartment and the drug dealers keep bothering you, it is safe. I'm not calling it safe.
Fakhri and others say they weren't expecting luxury when they arrived, but they often left nicer homes in Afghanistan.
I have noticed about almost 10 families, they left back this country.
They went back to Afghanistan?
Yes, they went back to Afghanistan, approximately 10 families.
Fakhri says there was one man who left when the rent support ended and he hadn't found a job. He told Fakhri he'd rather die in Afghanistan than suffer here. Still, despite the hardships that many Afghans face here, there are thousands more seeking visas in hopes of a better life in America. For Here and Now, I'm Sean Carberry.
Later this week, blues legend B.B. King will be memorialized at a service in Las Vegas. King died last week at the age of 89. Another blues musician who died last week was not nearly as well known as B.B. King. He was involved with the Music Maker Relief Foundation in North Carolina, a group that preserves and records Southern blues by supporting artists who are often old and poor. Back in the fall, Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd met him.
I'm Luther Mayer.
Boom, boom. Boom, 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 boom.
I'm also known as Captain Luke.
Boom, boom, boom.
My voice get down so low it untie your shoestring. That give you a problem tying them back up.
Captain Luke is 86 years old, and I barely saw him without a cigarette in his mouth. He wears a captain's hat, an accessory he picked up years ago working in a Winston-Salem drink house. A paisley tie is in a knot around his neck. For Captain Luke, the music started early.
I've been singing it since I was 14 years old, out in the cotton field plying with my uncle. Following him all day in the field plying, he blew the harmonica and he sung. And I was right behind him barefoot as a yard dog.
On that farm, Luther's uncle had a mule that worked alongside them. His name was Buck.
I just made up a song by him and King Bee. They see the little bees flying around, you know, the big old bummer bees out in the country, around the flowers and stuff. So I just thought I'd make a song. I could make a song out of clear blue like that.
When you were a little boy?
Yeah, and now.
Let's do it.
Yeah?
Can you sing the song about the bees?
Oh, boy, it's kind of hard for me to sing without a mic.
I got one right here.
Oh, there? Check, 1, 2, 3. I'm a king bee. I'm a king bee. Buzzing all night long. Won't be my queen bee, baby. Oh, you got to come on into my home.
He had a voice they'll never make another one like that.
Tim Duffy was Captain Luke's friend and the head of the Music Maker Relief Foundation. I spoke to him last week.
It's like honey over hot chocolate or a melted marshmallow. It just oozes and it makes you feel relaxed.
For 20 years, Duffy's group has been helping musicians like Captain Luke pay a heating bill or a doctor's bill. Duffy says much of American music, the stuff that inspired B.B. King and Muddy Waters, got its start from working class people in the South.
not everyone went on to be professional musicians. The majority are working mothers and fathers and working grandfathers and grandmothers who worked day laboring jobs and created this music on Saturday nights and Sunday morning in the church. And that's who Captain Luke was. He never thought of being a professional entertainer.
But late in life, he was. Captain Luke made 3 records with music makers. He toured through Europe. Captain Luke told me back in October that Duffy's Group was the best part of his life because he finally got to go somewhere. In his final weeks, fans from around the world who knew he was ailing called to wish Captain Luke farewell. Proof that his legacy and his low-down voice will live on. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
Keep on trucking, mama. That's all I got to say. I got a gal in New Orleans, the sweetest thing that I ever seen. Keep on trucking, mama. Trucking my blues.
Thousands of Israelis took to the streets in Jerusalem yesterday to celebrate the day the city was unified after the 1967 war, something not celebrated by Palestinians who see the city as their future capital occupied by Israel. A more harmonious portrait of Jerusalem can be found in a cookbook from 2012. In Jerusalem, a Cookbook, restaurateur Yotam Ottolenghi and chef Sami Tamimi collected memories of their childhoods, Yotam as a Jew in West Jerusalem and Sami a Palestinian in East Jerusalem. In the 3 years since its publication, Jerusalem, a Cookbook has become a sensation. Ottolenghi's early cookbook, Plenty, was popular, but Jerusalem has inspired what the New York Times called Jerusalem fever. And perhaps because of the book's culinary harmony, Brandeis University, which is non-sectarian but sponsored by the Jewish community, awarded Yotam Ottolenghi an honorary degree this past weekend, saying that in food you find not only a source of nourishment for the body, but also an essential ingredient in the recipe for global understanding. When Yotam Ottolenghi came to our studios, we asked what that citation meant to him.
Well, I think without ever intending to do that, the food that my co-author, Sami Tamimi, who is a Palestinian, I'm an Israeli, the food that we cook, the recipes that we've published have inspired people to cook Mediterranean food, to cook Middle Eastern food, and see us as kind of symbols of collaboration that unfortunately doesn't exist on the ground. So I think without ever intending for this to happen, it has happened, which is wonderful.
Both of you were living outside of Jerusalem and had been for years. You both met in London.
That's great. Yeah.
How does that work? A Jew from Jerusalem meets a Palestinian in another city? How does that work?
Well, you know, that it's funny because we are, you know, we are not those labels. We're just two people. You know, we're quite similar in many ways, and that similarity transcends everything else. And we're not political animals. In a sense, we're not really good representatives of our own cultures. So it's very easy for us to get on. And we love the same kind of food, and we love celebrating food and eating wonderful things and, you know, and cooking hummus or whatever, all those wonderful things.
By the way, you had us at Plenty. We were huge fans. But now, Jerusalem, what do you think of this explosion in popularity, people having potluck suppers around it and cooking their way through the books and blogs and Facebook posts? What do you make of that?
I don't know. I mean, obviously it struck a chord and people are enjoying this kind of food. In my mind, there's two elements to that. So in Plenty, in the sequel Plenty More, I've put the emphasis on vegetables, really. I mean, it was all about vegetables and how far you can take them and, you know, just discovering new ways. Because people were stuck in their own ways somehow with vegetables. They were kind of boiling them to death and doing horrible things. And I, all of a sudden, you know, Sami and I said, you can char-grill them and marinate them and use spices and tons of herbs and all sorts of wonderful things to make your vegetables taste really, really good. Jerusalem is a different story because it brings in a lot of the Middle Eastern flavors, things like tahini sauce and preserved lemon and pomegranate molasses and za'atar and all sorts of condiments and spices. Za'atar, it's a local spice or herb that's dried and mixed with sesame seeds, some salt, a couple of other things. And it's a really beautiful, it's got a really beautiful savory flavor. So all those things, we started using them and introducing them to people, and I think it made people go, ah.
Well, the New York Times did a deep look at cookbooks that capture the imagination, as they say yours has, and compared it to, for instance, The Joy of Cooking. They spoke to Marvin Taylor, who's at the Fales Library at NYU, who pointed out that The Joy of Cooking was a bestseller in 1931, 2 years after the stock market crash, when suddenly thousands of American women were cooking for themselves. So what do you think it is about this point in time that's making people who don't cook. And by the way, you can get everything online. You don't need a cookbook. Yeah. Why do you think they're embracing yours?
I think there is a certain element of liberation with the way I cook. It's extremely easy to follow. These are not complicated recipes, but they deliver tons of flavor.
Tick through some of your favorite ingredients. I know eggplant, eggs turn up a lot.
Yeah, eggplants. I use tons of yogurt in my recipe. I find it very useful. And I'm talking full fat, like creamy yogurt that you can put on anything that's hot, either in temperature or spicy, and it just tempers in a wonderful way. I use a lot of lemon juice, a lot of garlic. There's certain spices that I use a lot, like ground cardamom, ground turmeric, coriander seeds, all sorts of flavors that I'll describe as intense, as sharp, as warm.
There's an ingredient that begins with an F.
An Afrika.
Ah, what is that?
Afrika is a wheat. It's just normal wheat, but it's being harvested earlier before it dries, hence it's green, and it's got a slightly smoky flavor because it's part of the process. The bit of the wheat is being almost burned or singed, so it's got a nice green smoky flavor.
Okay, I have one that is going to stump people. Here's the watercress and chickpea soup with rose water and ras el hanout. It calls for 2.5 teaspoons of, is that ras el hanout?
Ras el hanout, yeah.
What is that?
It's a spice blend, essentially a North African spice blend that actually has, it means the top of the shop, which means the best spices that the stallholder, the shop owner has. The ras el hanout is the best spices put together. So some recipes have 15 spices, some have 25 in them. But essentially, there's a lot of sweet spices. Sometimes rose petals are added as well.
Yeah. People are saying when you eat this food, it gives you a feeling of an idealized place, a Jerusalem that's sun-baked with old rock walkways, and maybe you feel a splash of salt or something, when in fact it's a place that's riven, you know, by conflict. What else are you trying to telegraph with your book?
Well, you know, Jerusalem is a tormented place in many senses. I mean, it's a place that is unfortunately in conflict. You know, there's two people living there side by side and not getting on at all. Haven't for a very long time. So this is the basic situation. Now we, Sammy and I, are trying to make the most out of it. So out of the conflict and out of the, you know, the intensity of the emotions also come some amazing foods. People are trying really hard to make the best hummus. So if you go to Jerusalem, you can get a Jewish or Israeli hummus and you can get a Palestinian hummus. They're slightly different, maybe slight variation, but in a sense, it drives people to do the best food they can. And this whole kind of sense of passion about things really is very clear through the food. It comes through in a great way.
Well, you also write, I'm reading at the very beginning of the book, you both write about, well, it's titled A Comment About Ownership.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that? That's an odd way to start a cookbook.
The difficulty is that, you know, where to start. You know, in the Middle East, there's a small piece of land with two nations fighting over it. Everything is important, including the food. As a result, there was always a scramble over ownership. Who invented hummus? Who invented falafel? Who makes it better? Who owns it? Those are really crucial questions when the reality is very shaky and people are really scrambling for identity.
Yeah, well, and what do you conclude? Who owns hummus?
I will not take side. It's definitely an Arab dish. I mean, I don't think anyone would deny that. Palestinian, Lebanese, Syrian, you know, there's a lot of people who can take credit for it. But obviously it became the national food of Israel as well. So, you know, it belongs to everybody now. But, you know, it depends on your perspective. It's a very political thing. You know, a Palestinian would say, you know, this is our food that has been colonized. And Israeli would say, well, that's, you know, we cook it, we love it, we can share it. You know, it doesn't necessarily need to be one way or the other, but there's definitely a conflict around it.
Yeah. Well, you can go that deep into the region when you cook with the book, or you can just say, I can make it too. <You know? laughs> Yoram Ottolenghi, again with Sammy Tamimi, authors of Jerusalem, a cookbook. And we mentioned you're here in our area to receive an honorary degree at Brandeis. What would you tell young people setting out? You're going to be the cooks for the first time. What's the tip?
The tip is to cook what you feel passionately about, not try to follow a trend or follow an idea that is kind of beyond what you know or feel comfortable with. So I would never dare cook Scandinavian foods, even if it's very, very you know, trendy at the moment. I stick to what I know best and what I am best at.
And for those using the book, just some sort of tip, eggplant, salt it and dry it. Try to get some of the moisture out before you use it. I mean, what's your...
Well, if you ask me about eggplants, I'll tell you. I think the most important thing with eggplants, I like to roast my eggplants in the oven or broil. You call it here, sorry. Yeah. That's the American term.
We roast too.
Grill is broiling, right? Grilling, we call grilling broiling.
Anyway,
when you roast your eggplants, essentially what I say is you need to soak them with a lot of olive oil, a lot of salt and pepper, and you need to leave them in the hot oven for a very long time, like, you know, 25 minutes, half an hour, so until they go really nice and brown. Because the worst thing you can do is undercook an eggplant. You don't want it raw in the center, so keep it going for a little bit longer.
Okay. Yoram, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
How much money, if any, do you spend playing the lottery? Well, if you're an average person in one of the states that has a lottery, I'm guessing about $300 per year. That is according to recent data from the North American Association of State and Provincial Lotteries, which found that in 2014, Americans spent $70 billion on the lottery. That means more is spent per person on lotteries than on sports tickets, books, video games, or movie tickets. Derek Thompson joins us with more from New York. He's senior editor at The Atlantic. He's been writing about this. And Derek, $70 billion, is that a regular year for the lottery or is that a lot?
No, this is surprisingly essentially a regular year for the lottery. Mm. It's been about $70 billion for the last few years. And something about what you just said, it's not just that we spend more on lottery tickets than on sports tickets or books or video games or movie tickets. It's that we spend more on lottery tickets than all those things plus recorded music sales combined.
Wow.
That's how much $70 billion truly is. And when you think, you know, $300 per person, that's just the national average. On a state-to-state basis, it varies rather wildly.
And you could have people spending a lot more than that in any individual state. And this is big money for states, as we know. About 40% of ticket sales go into state revenue. Where does that money go and how much of state budgets typically rely on it?
So the money goes to all the places that one would expect states to spend money. It goes to health, it goes to education, to economic development, environmental upkeep. I mean, to give people a sense of how dramatic the disparity is between states, there are places like Rhode Island, South Dakota, Massachusetts, where people are spending $700 per person. That's more than twice the national average, almost three times the national average. You compare that to other states, Montana, Oklahoma, North Dakota, where they're spending far less than $100 per year. So very, very little. But overall, when you look at where this money is going to, it's going to state governments. It's going essentially to pay for the very same things that people want to be paid for anyway. Lotteries are a game, but at the same time, they are a tax. 40% of that money is taken by the state. 45% of any winnings over $600 are also taken by the federal and state governments. So this is a revenue-generating activity.
And you would argue that it's a regressive tax. You cite research from Duke University that found that the poorest third of households buy half of all lottery tickets. Now, the North American Association of State and Provincial Lotteries says on its website the lottery is not a regressive tax because it is voluntary. The question comes up, Derek, is it morally acceptable for states to be making money this way when we know that the poorest third of households are going to buy half of all lottery tickets? Those are who are paying that tax.
This is clearly a judgment call on which people have very strong opinions on both sides. I believe that it is immoral. I think it is pernicious to essentially prey upon the hopes of poor Americans to fund government, which should be paid for by the kind of taxes that we've actually seen declining in the last 20 years, like corporate income taxes. Mm. It seems pretty clear that lower income people are more likely to buy this as an investment and not just as a game. A clever study looked at it, compared movie tickets to lottery tickets, and found that local lottery ticket sales rise with poverty, but movie tickets do not. In other words, lotto games aren't merely just another form of cheap entertainment like movies. They're also a prayer against poverty. And so is this the kind of government, especially in an age of income inequality, that we want to fund? One that asks lower-income people who have been hurt by globalization and technology in the last 20 years to bear more of government spending and then to call it a voluntary act at the end. That seems to me to be too tricky and actually quite pernicious.
Well, it doesn't seem that your argument is being heard by states out there. Back in 1980, I see only 14 states held lotteries, and now it's up in the 40s.
At 43, including Washington, D.C. This is my take on that. A political cynic could say that lotteries are the perfect public policy because they're a tax without an organized lobby to oppose it. Every other big lottery, big tax in the country, a corporate income tax is going to anger corporations. A high individual tax rate is going to annoy rich people. But because lotteries are seen by so many as not only a game, but also possibly a ticket out of poverty, you don't have lower income and middle income people complaining the same way they would about other taxes. But it seems to me that what's happening here is that because the effective tax rate of lotteries at 40% or above is so high that what you're essentially doing is asking people to give you their prayers and then taxing their prayers against poverty. Even if there is no structured, organized lobby on K Street to actively and successfully fight against this at the national level and then at the state level as well, I still think that there is pretty clear demographic evidence that this is not a public policy we should be proud of.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. You can read more about this and weigh in with your thoughts at hereandnow.org. I have to say, I'll occasionally pick up one of the scratcher tickets, although never really thinking that I'm going to win. And when I do, I usually make back the $2 that I spent. Derek, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm glad to see you back. I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.